From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. An effort to save a plant is really about saving a culture.
I've been around sugarcane since I was a little boy, but the taste is just the sweetness of it and the juice content of it. It was the sweetest cane that I ever had before.
The sweetness of purple ribbon sugarcane. That's ahead this hour. First, though, we talked last week about how the High Museum of Art in Atlanta has tripled its non-white audience. Museum director Rand Suffolk says it's all been very deliberate.
It's about making a series of gestures, a series of decisions along the way, and staying committed to that and being very intentional about how we try and shift the demographics top to bottom at the organization. I can tell you that from a staff standpoint as well as from a board standpoint, we're very sensitive to that.
Here are your first thoughts. Mercy Mushina of Roswell, Georgia, recently visited the High Museum with her family and says the museum's African art reminds her of home.
I want to see Africans telling African stories. I'm originally from Kenya, so seeing a lot of Kenyan artists displayed and telling the Kenyan story, the East African story, that I love tremendously. It brought back a lot of memories, and it really has given me a lot, some newer perspectives on things that I didn't even know about the culture.
We'd love to get your thoughts. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Last week, a federal judge temporarily halted the Trump administration's plan to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. It's also known as DACA. It's unclear whether efforts to extend that program will be successful. President Trump rejected a tentative agreement reached by a small bipartisan group of senators to keep it going. Under DACA, some 800,000 young immigrants, often referred to as dreamers, can legally live and work in the U.S. Valentina Emilia Garcia Gonzalez is a dreamer, and years ago she moved with her family from Uruguay to Gwinnett County. She now attends Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, and I talked to her about how the DACA program has helped her.
I think what a lot of people don't understand is that the concept of legality and illegality when it comes to immigration is already set up rules. And so a lot of the time it comes down to privilege, right? In my country, we didn't have the privilege of even knowing how to come here legally and the legal ways of doing that. We were just very desperate to get out of a country. And my parents were very desperate to make sure that my brother and I were set up for success and for prosperity. So, you know, now I hear a lot of pushback and talking about, like, well, you should have done it right. Your parents should have done it right. You know, it's a lot of talk about, like, well, what is right? And if there is a way to do it legally, then why aren't there more legal immigrants, quote unquote, legal immigrants? And, you know, it comes back to the get in the line myth or get in the line excuse that people use. And there is no line. There is no concrete, easy, fast, legal way to become a citizen or a resident here.
But you have been here basically since you were in first grade. Do you consider yourself American?
Well, yes. I mean, besides being born in a South American country, and that already grants me Americanness, you know, yes, I do consider myself American because I've fully assimilated into this country. I know more about this country, its history, its people, its culture, everything, more so than Uruguay. You know, I like to think that Uruguay was like my birth country or like my birth mother that gave me up for adoption, and the United States took me with open arms and has given me everything.
So what changed for you? How different was it after Obama signed DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, as opposed to before?
I think that once DACA came about and I became a DACA recipient, the world opened up to me, right? It was very apparent to me, especially being in high school and seeing all my peers and all of my friends, being able to drive and do, I guess, the regular teen things, going out at night, doing, you know, driving. And then when it came to my senior year, applying to college, and I had to have a really rough conversation with my mother about being undocumented and what that meant for me. And that meant, you know, not being able to drive, not really going outside during certain times to not be caught by the police, changing my whole life and my whole life routine around just to avoid being seen and being known as an undocumented person. So once DACA did come about and Obama did sign that, I was able to work. I was able to help my parents and my family economically. I was able to get a license But the thing is with DACA, as, you know, thankful and as privileged as I am to be an undocumented person with DACA, what people don't understand is DACA is a very exploitative thing. The only thing that it grants me is a license and a work permit. It doesn't necessarily grant me a higher education, as is seen in Georgia, where undocumented students are banned from the top three universities now, where it used to be the top five, because of the Board of Regents Policy 416, and we are barred from financial aid because of Policy 434.
And DACA is expensive, too. You pay money to be part of that program. How much do you pay?
I think we pay around $500 to $600 to file that, and plus if we use an attorney to do that for us, it might be even more, like up to $1,000, $1,500.
So now that DACA has been or will be basically rescinded, what are you worried about?
Being at Dartmouth, I'm worried about my literal safety. And this is because I've had individual students and student organizations threaten to deport me. So my freshman year, there was an incident where I got a message from an individual student that if I ran for a student government position, that he could very easily call immigration. After Trump got elected, a student organization on campus said that they could call ICE and have all the undocumented students deported at Dartmouth. And, you know, people didn't understand that that is a direct threat to our lives. And it was just very hard.
I can't imagine if you were deported back to Uruguay, what would you do? You were six when you left there.
Right. I think being my 15 years being in the United States, I've thought about it a lot. I've grown up in this country with just my parents and my siblings. You know, I have seen my friends go to their cousin's house, their grandparents' house, and my grandparents died while I have been in this country. I don't know where they're buried. I wasn't there for them when they died. If I were to go back to Uruguay, my whole family, the six of us, we'd be living in a shed with an outhouse with maybe electricity. And to liken that to where we live now, where we live in a house, where we have, you know, a dog, we have food in our fridge, we have all these privileges, and to go back to a country that I literally know nothing about would be just devastating.
That's Valentina Emilia Garcia Gonzalez. She's one of the young immigrants protected under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. A federal judge last week temporarily halted plans by the Trump administration to end that program. Last year, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions defended the president's push to eliminate DACA with this claim.
It also denied jobs to hundreds of thousands of Americans by allowing those same illegal aliens to take those jobs.
We want to fact check that, not just that, but many other things related to DACA. Wesley Tharp is research director with the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. Good morning.
Morning, Celeste. Pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you back. Can we start with this? The Jeff Sessions claim that DACA denied jobs to hundreds of thousands of Americans?
That's outright false, Celeste. It's a common misconception that immigrants, whether here on a legal permanent basis or a temporary lawful basis or having originally come to the country illegally, are taking jobs from native-born Americans. But what actually happens with immigration is that immigrants grow the size of the economy as a whole by being workers, entrepreneurs, contributing to their communities, being taxpayers, and so for every job that an individual foreign-born person may, quote-unquote, take, let's say, for example, an immigrant taking a job on a construction site, they create jobs elsewhere in the economy by circulating those dollars throughout the economy that essentially cancel out any of the lost jobs or, some economists believe, benefit the economy perhaps substantially over time.
And this is backed up by numbers. This is not your gut feeling.
Oh, absolutely. This is, I would say, the consensus of mainstream research on the economic benefit of immigrants is that over the long term in particular, the benefits are absolutely positive of additional immigrants coming to communities and to the country as a whole, in the same way we see benefits from native-born people coming to Metro Atlanta to Georgia, as opposed to these communities who are losing population over time. There's some debate about what are the short-term impacts, because there, you know, are there are some pressures there, particularly
short-term
in certain
means
industries.
6 months to a year, or
When, say, there's a heightened amount of immigration in a short-term period, are there jobs being, again, quote-unquote, taken in certain industries that might have a large percentage of immigrants? But, again, the consensus, I would say, is that those impacts, even in the short term, are either zero or just very, very minor.
Let's hear this comment from Alex Narasta of the Cato Institute. He says about 91% of DACA recipients are employed. This is him speaking on Fox Business.
They pay in federal taxes about $60 billion a year over the next decade, more than they consume in benefits. And their contribution to American GDP over the next decade will be about $280 billion. Rescinding their work permits does not mean that they leave the United States, does not kick them out. It merely means that they're deprived of jobs.
So if that means that they lose their jobs, that means we lose that $60 billion in taxes if DACA is rescinded?
Right, and let me bring this home to Georgia in particular. Our research indicates that the about 47,000 Dreamers in Georgia, people who are either receiving DACA currently or who are immediately eligible to apply, contribute $66 million a year to Georgia in state and local tax revenue. If those young people who were brought to this country as children were deported, Georgia would lose that entire $66 million a year. If they lose their DACA status but were allowed to stay, they wouldn't be working as often. They would be receiving lower wages, and so that contribution would shrink substantially.
So, okay, let's hear another comment. And this is sort of talking about their wages. This is Richard Trumka, and he oversees the AFL-CIO, the union. He says ending DACA would actually make workplaces less safe.
It'll make it more difficult for us to come together to raise wages for everybody. There are 800,000 people that are making contributions every single day, taking away their rights, making them exposed to being fired at will is not only cruel, it's very, very wrong for the economy. It's a wrong thing to do.
What do we know about the way that DACA recipients in particular affect wages or labor standards?
That's a very good question. I would say that legal status for the immigrant community does have very important implications for workers as a whole, because when there is a large pool of potential workers that don't have the ability to negotiate, don't have the ability to
complain,
to what have you, it undercuts the legal workforce. And so that's just one example of how having a system for immigrants to be treated fairly, bring them into the fabric of our communities and our economy, spills over into benefits for people as a whole, regardless of whether they were born here or what their legal status is.
That's Wesley Tharp of the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. I spoke to him last year. Just ahead, the rural areas of Georgia are losing population. But first, how sugarcane is being used to help save Gullah culture. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Purple ribbon sugarcane is an important part of Gullah Geechee culture, and it tastes different from its tropical relative. It thrived on Sapelo Island off the Georgia coast until disease nearly wiped it out altogether. But it's been revived thanks to a team of farmers, geneticists, and historians. I talked about this project with Jerome Dixon. He owns the Georgia Coastal Gourmet Farms, and also David Shields of the University of South Carolina. Shields is an expert in Southern cuisine. And Cornelia Bailey of Sapelo Island Culture and Revitalization Society. Sadly, Cornelia died at the end of last year. In our interview, though, I asked her to explain how purple ribbon sugarcane is important to Gullah Geechee culture.
Well, I guess all sugarcane at the time was important to the Gullah Geechee culture because we had no choice. We were planting it during the days of slavery to make syrup so and you know, and make sugar with. So it was important. But then it became important to us individually after that, because then we planted it for our own use. We also had small mills, and we grind them into syrup and that sort of stuff. And so we had our own way. It was for medicinal purposes, it was for food purposes. So we had our own uses for it.
David, why did purple ribbon sugarcane, purple ribbon sugarcane, as I understand it, was imported to North America and the States sometime in the 1800s from the West Indies? And it did well for a long time. Why did it almost die out?
Well, it's a very interesting type of cane. There had been many attempts to grow sugar in the colonial period and process it, but the cold weather on the mainland would kill back most sugar canes. But this purple ribbon was cold tolerant, had thicker walls than other sugar canes, and so enabled for the first time substantial quantities of sugar to be produced on the mainland. And for close to a century, it was the standard crop cane throughout the South. But Sapelo Island, in terms of the East Coast, was the ground zero for the production of this at the Spalding Sugar Works. And then at the beginning of the 20th century, various offsprings of the purple ribbon sugar cane, like blue ribbon cane and Louisiana purple cane, were found to be more productive and less disease vulnerable. And they supplanted the parent cane, and it ceased to be grown except by very few people who were cane syrup fanatics and loved the taste.
Let me play you this comment from Stephen Kresovich, a geneticist at Clemson University who has worked on this project. He talked about how tough it was to actually bring back this plant without an original sample.
The challenge that we have is we have the DNA profiles of what we have. What we don't have is a DNA sample of something that's documented to be purple ribbon from 1815 from Sapelo Island.
David, why couldn't they just bring purple ribbon back again from the West Indies?
Well, it's not found there right now. And indeed, we went through a search of all of the world germplasm banks looking for this sugar cane. Steve Kresovich is a very famous cane geneticist and well-connected, and it was not to be found.
Jerome, is there a significant difference between the taste of purple ribbon and the regular sugar cane we buy at the store?
Well, the purple ribbon, it's the first time that I've ever handled it in my life. And I've been around sugar cane since I was a little boy. But the taste is just the sweetness of it and the juice content of it. It was the sweetest cane that I ever handled before.
And does that mean that the recipes, Cornelia, that purple ribbon sugarcane is used in, are those taste different as well?
It basically tastes the same, but like Jerome said, the amount of juice that you get from it gives you a higher volume of syrup once it boils down. And there was a slight difference in it because some was a little thicker than some, but once you put it on biscuit, it didn't matter.
So, Cornelia, I mean, yes. Now that we know a little bit about purple ribbon sugarcane, what role could this particular cane play in bringing young people back to Sapelo Island?
That's what I'm hedging my bet on. I'm hedging on the fact that if we successfully grow in this, then the young people get interested. I'm talking it up to the young people as we speak. I'm telling the young people what a great thing it'll be. It'll be environmentally safe and so forth. And I got them interested. So that if we can grow it in a large quantity, I think we got the makings to bring some young people back to the island, which we need desperately.
Jerome, are you hedging your bets that way also? Are you also hoping that the growing of this cane can bring some young people back?
Well, I'm definitely hopeful. And I would say even me being going back over there working with Cornelia on the island, I mean, it's a start. You know, at one point I wasn't interested, but I mean, it's just something that's so phenomenal to be able to handle something by choice now. Once upon a time, our ancestors had to do it, you know, by force. So now we're able to do it at our own leisure, and I'm hoping that everybody would want to get on board to do it, you know.
I sure hope so. Well, we're getting ready to lime our field. It's already plowed up, and we're going to put some lime on it. And hopefully next week, ours is already sprouted up about a foot, like you said, and we're from 6 to 12 inches, so we have to carefully remove it from the bank, what we call it, the bank, and carefully remove it from that and transport it to the field.
David, I'll play you another comment from Stephen Kresovich. He's talking about growing purple ribbon sugarcane in particular.
It's a difficult crop to work with because you're dealing with ultimately stalks that might be 10 to 12 feet tall and weigh 3 to 4 pounds. That's different than taking small amounts of seed out of the field that represent an important variety. So sugarcane production is reasonably challenging, and the people at Saplo recognize that, and they are trying to understand or think about how they want to best handle the material.
What are the challenges to turning purple ribbon sugarcane into a crop that can make money and actually produce these jobs?
Well, one of the things which has to be decided is to what extent they want to process the cane on the island. Now, the word of this sugar cane has gone out through the culinary networks of the South, and distillers would like to get their hold on the juice to make rum out of. And they would take the stalks out and juice them themselves by direct. That would require the least amount of processing. But what is more traditional is the making of cane syrup. And there was an actual sugar cane mill that operated on that island, one of the largest in the United States, for over 80 years that produced granulated sugar. That would entail more capital investment. So I think the initial things would be to sell the canes directly to people who would want to process them, and their chefs who would love to get cane juice as well.
Cornelia, you said you're already having these discussions with young people. What kind of response or interest are you getting?
They seem to be interested. My son is in it. My cousin Arjean is in it. My cousin Baba Jean. So a lot of them got the ears all perked up and ready to go. So,
what would they wait? What do you think they would be waiting on to actually get them to move back?
Show and tell.
What does that mean?
That means they're gonna have to see. They're interested in it. They don't mind planting it and helping me plant it, but they want to see how fast it grows, how much we can produce, and where we can sell it to. And then they could really sink their teeth in it and said, hey, I can make a living doing this. So it's like show and tell. So we're the ground force. Jerome and I and others, we're the ground force to show the young people that it can be done. So
yes.
Jerome, how much are you hoping to plant eventually? How big of a purple ribbon sugarcane crop do you hope to have?
I'm looking to maybe at some point get to at least 5 acres of sugarcane, and that is a tremendously lot of cane.
That's
a lot of cane. Yeah,
it's a lot of cane.
Would you need extra help to do that?
Would need help. You would probably would have to try to move to some kind of mechanism where, you know, some kind of machinery to be able to do that you know, handling that much of cane, you know.
And, David, if purple ribbon starts taking hold, how do we protect it from, again, almost dying out?
Well, that's why we bring scientists in. The Carolina Gold Rice Foundation makes sure that, you know, the best agricultural science backs up what, you know, goes on. There's a very traditional saltwater Geechee way of planting cane, but, you know, you have to make sure that the cane varieties that in the ground are the right ones and are genetically sound and not vulnerable, and that's where Dr. Kresovich comes in, and we have pledged our support all the way down the line to make sure that what they're producing will have the least problems with pests and pathogens. So,
Cornelia, what would I, if I had some purple ribbon sugar cane, what would you suggest I make with it? What's the best use of it?
If you just only had a little bit, then you're going to have to process it into syrup. And then it's good for syrup cornbread. It's good for people who like syrup on their rice, which I never did like as a child. And my grandfather did. And my father used it for medicinal purposes as well.
Medicinal and, purposes? What does the cane syrup cure?
They made a tea for men who were working in the sun all day. And they said it keep them from getting a stroke or getting the bear. Is they would leave from home in the morning and they would have a quart jar with syrup tea in it. And they would sip on that during the heat of the day.
That was my 2016 conversation with the late Cornelia Bailey of the Sapelo Island Cultural and Revitalization Society. We also heard from Georgia Coastal Gourmet Farms owner Jerome Dixon and David Shields of the University of South Carolina. This month, a new Savannah restaurant began serving dishes that feature purple ribbon sugarcane. Tyler Williams is the chef at Husk Savannah. Hi there, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
So what is the, I mean, obviously ingredients matter when you're cooking things, but what is the difference between different strains of sugar?
Well, there are refined sugars, and then there are sugars indicative of space and place. And we at Husk try to strive to move away from these refined sugars and into more natural sugars, especially following the culture of the Low Country, where people would use either cane or sorghum and boil down the sugar from their little plot that they grew each year, and that would subsist them throughout the year for all their sugar needs. And that's my goal at the restaurant with my cooking.
What does purple ribbon sugarcane taste different?
Absolutely. It was such a surprise. It was a delight. It is so much darker and more mysterious than your usual blonde sugarcane syrup. It has these truffle notes to it, and this grassiness and this salty, sweet luxuriousness to it that is just a blessing to have this world-class product. And on the first go-round, you know, usually people plant sugarcane for yield or mix and match different varietals. They're not grown for this high sugar content. And the space and place of Sapelo and where Jerome is at Coastal Gourmet Farms, it just brings that terroir to it that makes a real unique feeling and flavor of where we are in the world.
And I understand, Cornelia was talking about the process of turning it into a syrup, and I understand you guys serve it with the cornbread, but what's a good recipe?
A fancy biscuit.
Yeah. what recipe is best served with a purple ribbon sugar cane?
Well, it's so fantastic unadulterated, but I'm in love with the idea of pressing it fresh with ginger grown on the island and turmeric and sour orange and making that like the best lemonade or drink that we could have. It's beautiful lacquered on wild game. It has those truffle notes.
To make like a glaze, you mean?
Oh, absolutely. You know, wild game is a very storied part of our culture down here, where people will just love to go out in the rice fields and hunt and bringing things that are so that, well, you know, things that grow together go together.
Yeah.
You know, I'm on the hunt for the chinkapin. I want to put this syrup with chinkapin. I think, you know, the chestnut and truffle is just a beautiful pairing, wild game. But we make a beautiful Sapelo Island cane cake at the restaurant.
Yeah.
Whipped, obviously, you know, everybody likes honey butter, so,
yeah.
So we're doing our replication of that for our cornbread.
And this would be a very sweet form of that. Tyler Williams is the chef at the restaurant Husk Savannah. It opened this month, so congratulations and thank you
well,
so
thank
much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for getting me up so early.
It's good for the health. Just ahead, the disappearing population of rural Georgia. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. Tomorrow, we'll look at a drive to remove the name Talmadge from the bridge in Savannah and then rename it for the founder of the Girl Scouts. That group was founded in Savannah. If you could rename a landmark, or maybe name it after someone, who would you name it after? Name a landmark for us and tell us what name you would choose. Call us at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us for that conversation tomorrow at 9. Last September, Georgia Tech student Scout Schultz was shot to death by a campus police officer. According to investigators, Schultz called 911 to report an armed, suspicious person on campus. When police arrived, they found Schultz holding a blade, and a video of the incident shows police demanding Schultz put it down. After repeated commands, an officer opened fire. Schultz was suicidal and was one of 30 Georgians shot and killed by police last year. And according to data compiled by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, a quarter of these shootings involved mental illness. AJC reporter Brad Schrade has been tracking these cases and joins me on the line now. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Celeste. How you doing?
We should remind everyone that the reason the AJC is tracking these is because no other entity actually tracks police shootings. Is that true both locally, statewide, and in the federal level?
Yes. A couple years ago, we took a deep dive into this and started asking basic questions about police shootings after Ferguson. And what we found is a lot of other media outlets, and reporters found was that no police force, no state agency, no federal agency has a reliable accounting of this. So we decided to go back to 2010 in Georgia and start tracking these and looking into these cases. And what we found is a lot of these cases, about a fourth of them or a third, depending on which number you look at, it involves some sort of mental illness, involving the person who is shot.
But because it's so difficult to get the information on these deaths, how convinced are you that 30 is the correct number of Georgians who are shot and killed by police?
Well, I think at this point, we feel pretty confident that we have a full accounting for the past 8 years and to be fair, the GBI is now basically the de facto investigative agency for most of these police shootings in Georgia. And they're
the GBI is the Georgia Bureau of Investigation.
Yep. They're starting to, compile their own comprehensive list. And so I think, moving forward, they plan to start publicly reporting some of this. The FBI, a year or two ago, James Comey, the former director now, committed to the FBI looking at this, basically saying, media outlets should not be – the Washington Post is doing this on a national level in real time. Media outlets should not be the ones that are the authority on this. The law enforcement agencies need to do this. The federal FBI is doing this. The GBI is taking this much more seriously. And so hopefully moving forward at some point, media outlets will not be the authority on this. It'll be, there'll be some public reporting by police.
In any of these cases from last year, of the 30 Georgians who were shot and killed by police, in any of those cases, was a police officer either held accountable or punished?
All these cases are still open, so there's not, there's not any, nobody's been indicted from this group of cases, and they're right now, it's, I'm not sure that anybody will be. There's the taser case in, I believe, Washington County, which is not in our list because it's not a police shooting case. Obviously, there were officers indicted from that.
Yeah.
But in terms of the police shootings right now, there are none that have been charged or indicted.
In fact, it's fairly rare, if not non-existent, in the list for the past since 2010.
Yeah, but there are some officers that in recent times in Georgia have been indicted. There was the DeKalb officer from the 2015 case, and that involved mental illness.
Yeah.
You recall the veteran who was naked in his apartment complex and Chamblee was shot. He was unarmed. And then there was a 2016 case of an Atlanta police officer who was indicted and fired and then later indicted, and he's awaiting trial. So there are some signs that there's, you know, maybe more accountability or a little bit more. But yes, it's very rare. And one thing that the public doesn't understand, and it's hard to grasp even, you know, when you start looking at these cases, just because something looks suspicious and may be suspicious and may be questionable doesn't mean it's illegal. And that's where I think a lot of the kind of consternation and protest from the public. It's like some of these cases don't look reasonable, and they yet the police have a very broad authority in the country to use their judgment, particularly if they feel like they're in danger. And how do you prove somebody didn't feel like they were in danger? So the threshold is very high to hold officers criminally accountable in these. One thing in our story that we published a week ago that police are trying to do is try to have more training around recognizing mental illness, recognizing ways to de-escalate. And so hopefully there will be fewer of these if police can find ways to de-escalate some of these cases so that they don't turn violent. The Georgia Tech case, that officer had not had the 40-hour course that Georgia's now encouraging all police to take to recognize and de-escalate mental, you know, when you confront a mentally ill person that, that's a very unpredictable situation or can be. So hopefully there will be some lowering, but right now the number we had from last year, 30, is right on mark with what has happened in recent history. So there doesn't seem to be any kind of lowering of this. And the Washington Post, again, reported about 1,000 cases last year of fatal shootings, and that was not any kind of, decrease. So while there's been a lot of attention, there's still the same kind of drumbeat of deaths that a lot of people find distressing.
Well, then let's kind of dig into what may have changed, because you guys have been looking into police shootings for a few years now, 2 or 3 years. Has the conversation with law enforcement changed for you as a reporter?
Well, I think there's more. I think by accounting for these, and again, when we started, when after Ferguson, the country was very much in the dark about this. We didn't know how many police shootings occurred. We didn't know the circumstances of a lot of these. And so without that kind of accounting, law enforcement agencies in many ways were flying dark, flying into the dark on this and not really recognizing that, if there's no analysis of these shootings, how do you train for it? How do you prevent it? And so I think there's a rising consciousness among some police, particularly police leaders, that, you know, this is serious stuff. A whole community and state can be thrown into turmoil with one split-second decision by a police officer. So not only do they not want people, you know, getting shot and killed by the police unnecessarily, but, you know, there's a lot. The stakes are very high when, you know, a video gets posted and an entire community can be thrown into turmoil. And, you know, so it's, the stakes are much higher. And I think police are trying, particularly progressive police, you know, leaders are recognizing this is really important that we have to come to grips with this.
As reporter Brad Schrade of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Brad, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Metro Atlanta continues to expand, but the population in rural Georgia is shrinking. Photographer Brian Brown is documenting the architecture of the countryside before it disappears, and he started where he grew up in Ben Hill County near Tifton. He now has websites devoted to North and Coastal Georgia as well. Hi there, Brian.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
I got to ask you, how many miles do you put on your car every year?
15,000-20,000 at least.
That's a lot.
That's probably a conservative estimate, but yeah.
So when this began, what drew you? Did you just start taking photos of this by chance, or did you already begin with this mission of documenting disappearing sort of architecture?
Well, I did have that as my mission. A lot of places around my home that I remember from my childhood. After I lived in Atlanta for a while and came back to South Georgia, I noticed so many places disappearing, and so I felt an urgent need to get out and document those places. And I just expanded as I used up what was in my area. I began to expand out, and it's grown from there.
What was the first building you photographed?
I think probably a farmhouse or tobacco barn near my family's farm in Ben Hill County that has since lost as well. Those structures that I photographed are gone too.
They're gone?
Yes.
Did they fall or they were demolished?
They fell. Well, actually one fell, one was demolished, yeah. And I find that with a lot of different places that I photograph. And go back a year or two later wanting to re-photograph something, I find that it's gone. So a lot of these structures in rural Georgia are disappearing. We take them for granted. The people call them sharecropper shacks and things like that. And we've seen them our whole lives, and we pass by them on rural roads, and we just think they're always going to be there, but they're really going quickly.
What's the difference between, say, your tobacco barn that may have fallen down or been demolished and an office building in Metro Atlanta that is demolished and replaced with a parking lot? Is there a difference in terms of the purpose of documenting?
I think they're all important. It's easier for me to concentrate just on rural at this time, and that's been sort of a conundrum for me as to should I venture into more urban areas. Like Savannah is a lot easier than Atlanta, to document things in. But I think any sort of things, a lot of modern architecture from the mid-20th century is being torn down as well. So there's an urgency to document some of that as well. But right now, like I said, it's easier for me to do rural, but I get what I can.
Well, tell me about a building that just broke your heart when it came down.
Oh, there's so many. That's a tough one. Well, one in particular up in Central Georgia that actually had a good ending, but the courthouse in Hancock County in Sparta, Georgia, a few years ago burned. And that county was lucky enough to have the funds and to be able to get the funds to rebuild that courthouse exactly like it was before. The brick walls of the courthouse survived the fire, and they had good architects and preservationists come in and rebuild the courthouse. And I went up a year or so ago when they rededicated it, and that was actually a miracle to see that emerge from the ashes, as it were.
So you had a photo of the original building and then a photo of the one it was replaced with after the fire?
Yes.
Wow.
I did. I was lucky to do that. And it really looks almost exactly the same. It's amazing what they did with that.
So, do you feel that the speed at which these buildings are disappearing is faster now?
It's a lot faster. In fact, it's overwhelming me as far as, do I go here, do I go there? I get a lot of feedback from people on my websites and people telling me that, this building or that building is going to be torn down any time. And it's hard to be able to go to all of them and capture all of them. But I'm doing my best.
So do you keep a list or a map where you plot out where you're going to go?
I do have kind of a working list of references that people give me of places and just basically work from that list. And the main thing for me is to try to stay off the main highways. It's just get on the back roads and look for things, because Georgia has a fairly good record of documenting important architecture, nice big houses, mansions, things like that. But this rural or vernacular architecture that is widespread throughout the state, or was widespread throughout the state, has never really been documented much. And so I feel like I came in late in the game, but I'm glad to be able to get some of it before it's all gone.
So what is the secret to getting a really great photo of one of these buildings?
It's wintertime is a good time to shoot, because a lot of the structures that I photograph are often overgrown with vines, kudzu, things like that in the summer. But mostly just try to get them in their natural state before they've been. Sometimes people do restore structures. Most of my viewers on my sites prefer them in their more natural, abandoned state, you know, so it's hard to decide sometimes.
But that means, I mean, I've seen some of these photos, you need, like, gear. Yeah. Like, it looks like you're kind of trekking off sometimes into some wild places to get these photos.
Yes, I do. Mainly bug spray is the main gear you need here.
I'm sure. Although, you know, we do have snakes here in Georgia.
Yeah. I try to be careful. And, of course, you try to be respectful of property, you know, property rights and things like that. Mostly try to shoot from the road or just the right of way. And that's one thing I try to tell other photographers that are pursuing these sorts of things. Mainly stay off private property as much as you can, you know.
Yeah. Well, we only have about a minute left, and I just wanted to make sure I asked you what your chosen camera is.
I use a Nikon D90 at the present time.
And you carry lenses with you, I assume?
I generally do. 18-105 is the one I use mostly for architectural shooting. But I'm fairly self-taught as a photographer, so I'm not a complete gearhead when it comes to photography.
Yeah.
I use what served me well. I've gone from the D70 to the D90. So right now, Nikon is what I've been using. And sometimes I use a tripod. I should probably use one more often, but that's not always easy, the kind of photography I do.
That is photographer Brian Brown. You can see his really beautiful pictures from the project Vanishing Georgia. Visit our website, gpbnews.org. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's nice being here.
That's a show for today, but we always would love to hear from you. Nominate a building for Brian. Is there an old home, maybe a shack or tobacco barn in your town that you want to document before it is gone? Give us a call. Tell us about it. It's 404-500-9457. You can also post on social media. For today, that's on Second Thought. From GPB News, I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.